I'm Danny. Danny Schechter.
Known as the news dissector.
You know, I joined the media. Preserving democracy. Do something about the problems of the world. I'm the author. I'm the producer.
Hey, hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Issues. The history of the world.
Hey, hello, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
That's me, that's what I think.
Hey, rooted in all the way crack.
Demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted the media. Issues. That's me, that's what I think. Danny Schechter, your news dissector, what do you think?
What do you think? A good question, and a question that we'll get into in more detail today here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Pilar is off today, but I'm here to talk with you really about intelligence. That's what we're going to be exploring. In the first segment, the CIA. Did the CIA play a role in Nelson Mandela's capture in South Africa? And if so, how come it's been covered up for most of these years and didn't even surface in a lot of the various obits that we read about him when he died last month at age 95? There's a graduate student or a student at MIT who is now filing suit under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act, demanding information about what the CIA knows about Mandela. When did they stop knowing it? And what can we learn from it? And we're going to talk with him in a minute. His name is Ryan. Ryan. I'm blanking today. But we'll introduce you properly in a minute, and we'll hear more about your effort to try to get the truth on this important historical moment. And in the second half of the program, we'll introduce you to a lawyer who has been very active on behalf of the people in Pennsylvania who raided the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971, exposed confidential files. It's all been revealed in a new book and a film, and we're going to have more from the person who was there who can tell us more detail about all of this. So stay with us today on Progressive Radio Network, PRN FM.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sound stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Time is right, and
waiting
pressures.
News Goop, what we need to know. News Goop, what we want to know. We got News Goop, what we think we know.
Till freedom is a rumor.
News Goo, what we need to know. News Goo, what we want to know.
News Goo, that's what we're getting from many of our news outlets, information that's been so processed and sanitized and devoid of truth that it just reinforces prejudice, reinforces partisan politics, but doesn't really do much to inform us about what's really going on. And one of the events, of course, of the last year that got a tremendous amount of attention, and rightly so, is the death of the leader of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, who died at age 95 on December 5th. Mandela had been a leader of a liberation struggle. He had been in prison for 28 years in South Africa. He's also the subject, I should disclose, of a new book of mine called Madiba, A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. So it's an effort to try to bring more of the many Mandelas to public attention. attention. And this is all tied in with the movie Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, which is still playing just this afternoon. Idris Elba, who performs as Nelson Mandela in this movie, was recognized with a nomination in the NAACP Image Award. So more on that in a minute. But we want to talk a little bit about one important set of facts that have been sort of, you know, erased, if you will, from most journalistic accounts. And that is what happened in terms of the arrest of Nelson Mandela. And did the CIA play a role? And what role did it play? Noah is with us, Shapiro. Ryan Noah Shapiro, who's a student, who's taken it upon himself to sue under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act to try to get the government to come clean on what its role was in all this. What motivated you to do this?
Hi, Danny. Thanks so much for having me on. Well, I mean, though the U.S. intelligence community is long believed to have been involved in Mandela's arrest, as you said, little specific public information exists, and though the U.S. intelligence community is also long understood to have routinely provided information to the South African regime regarding the anti-apartheid movement, little public information exists about these activities either. And despite being universally hailed as a hero and freedom fighter against gross injustice, Mandela was designated a terrorist by the United States government and remained on the U.S. terror watch list until 2008. I want to know what the role of the United States intelligence community was in Mandela's arrest and in surveilling and subverting the anti-apartheid movement, and in maintaining Mandela's designation and the ANC's designation as a terrorist threat to this country.
To find that out, what have you done? What steps have you taken now?
So I've submitted Freedom of Information Act requests to the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, and the FBI, and the CIA has failed to comply with my Freedom of Information Act request. They've missed the statutory deadline to within which they can comply. Basically, they've ignored my request, which is a violation of federal law. And so I've sued the CIA to compel them to comply with federal law, in this case, the Freedom of Information Act.
And the goal of the Freedom of Information Act is what? Tell us about this FOIA statute, because many people don't know about it and certainly don't realize that one can make a request under the FOIA for information, as I did, which I'll tell you about in a minute.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. Well, the Freedom of Information Act is actually one of the most underappreciated elements of the entire American experiment. I mean, as broken as FOIA is, and it is, the notion that the records of government are the property of the people and all we need to do to get them is to ask for them is just radically democratic. The Freedom of Information Act is an act that says any records maintained by large portions of the government, not all of it, not the judicial branch and not the legislative branch, but any records maintained by large portions of the executive branch are the property of the people, and all we need to do to get them is to ask. As I said, FOIA is broken, and it at times can be tremendously difficult to actually make good on FOIA, especially when dealing with intelligence agencies like the CIA, FBI, or DIA, or NSA. But nonetheless, I mean, the government works for us. The records they produce are our property. And the Freedom of Information Act is a not entirely fulfilled promise to make those records that belong to us actually available to us. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. Well, the Freedom of Information Act is actually one of the most underappreciated elements of the entire American experiment. I mean, as broken as FOIA is, and it is, the notion that the records of government are the property of the people and all we need to do to get them is to ask for them is just radically democratic. The Freedom of Information Act is an act that says any records maintained by large portions of the government, not all of it, not the judicial branch and not the legislative branch, but any records maintained by large portions of the executive branch are the property of the people, and all we need to do to get them is to ask. As I said, FOIA is broken, and it at times can be tremendously difficult to actually make good on FOIA, especially when dealing with intelligence agencies like the CIA, FBI, or DIA, or NSA. But nonetheless, I mean, the government works for us. The records they produce are our property, and the Freedom of Information Act is a not entirely fulfilled promise to make those records that belong to us actually available to us.
Well, back in the 1970s, when I was the news dissector at WBCN Radio, I was reporting on an effort by then-Congresswoman, the late Congresswoman from New York, Bella Abzug, who was demanding the release of her records as a Congresswoman under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. And since she was doing it and it was reported, I said, well, why shouldn't I try also? So I submitted a request to the FBI, to the CIA, and to the National Security Agency for information that they might have about me. You know, I suspected that they had such information, and I was interested in how did they get it. What were they spying on me? Were they tapping my phones? Were they monitoring my mail? And what techniques were being used to, you know, spy on, you know, ordinary citizens? In my case, I was also a journalist. So this was
right.
Also, you know, in a way, a double violation because, you know, for journalists to be spied on interferes with the First Amendment of our Constitution. In any event,
indeed,
it took me quite a while. And I wrote really over the top letters in that period, you know, demanding the information in the name of the International Declaration of Human Rights and anything I could think of. And I didn't hear back and I didn't hear back and I didn't hear back. And then finally, I did get a letter with an announcement of some files that they had on me. Those files were, you know, what do you call it? Completely blacked out.
Right. Redacted.
Redacted is the word, right. And so I got this information, but I got a piece of paper that was mostly, you know, black on white with no writing on it, as well as certainly evidence that they were monitoring me, or at least they had records on me. I was a journalist in London in 1966 and 67, where I was investigating the CIA, actually, for a magazine called Ramparts that no longer exists, which was the magazine that exposed CIA infiltration in the American student movement and CIA infiltration in many other areas as well. Ramparts was a very slick magazine. It was progressive, but it was done in a way that was very splashy. The editors, when they published an issue, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times to promote it. I mean, it was a real attempt to challenge, you know, most of the media at the time. And Ramparts, based in San Francisco, had a really strong, aggressive approach to trying to reveal information and also oppose the war in Vietnam at that time. And so I was in London and, you know, was meeting with various people. And I later learned that, of course, the CIA was monitoring my activities. They knew where I lived. They had had access to my mail. I think they had access to my phones, but none of that was disclosed in any detail. So they would send me information, then I would appeal their decision, saying that it was inadequate. It wasn't a full disclosure of what they had on me, and then they would send me back something else. With the NSA, interestingly enough, I then got the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts to represent me in this matter. And so the NSA denied access to information, and a judge in Massachusetts actually overturned the NSA decision and ordered them to disclose the information that I was seeking, which I would say, wow, you know, now we're getting somewhere. But that decision was appealed by the NSA, and on appeal, the government did not reveal the information. Some years later, I got a note from the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts saying, you know, what should they do with all these files on me that they had in their filing cabinets? You know, should they send them back to the CIA? Should they hold on to them? And I had them send them to me. So I have them, moldering in some filing cabinet right now. They're not terribly revealing, except in the sense that they reveal that the CIA was and the FBI were spying on people, which we now know in more detail about. And in the case of the FBI, I was a civil rights activist at Cornell University in upstate New York, and we picketed a local Woolworth store, as part of the boycott of Woolworth's lunch counters, which were segregated in the South. And there you go, in my files from the FBI, this brave moment of resistance by 15 people became part of the records of the United States of America. And in those records, I noticed that the FBI spelled Negro with a small N. They used terminology which today would not be acceptable, and which wasn't really acceptable then. But it's a kind of an insight into their mindset. We're going to be talking a little bit more with the people later on who were part of this raid on an FBI office in the appropriately named town of Media, Pennsylvania, where an FBI office was invaded by an activist, a part of the Catholic left, who made off with a tremendous number of documents. So now you've actually filed this request, and the CIA said, well, too late to give you any information?
Well, that's a lot of stuff there. In my case, the CIA just ignored me, and so I'm suing. I also want to say that the folks that you're going to have on in a bit, the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI who raided the FBI office in Media in 1971 are true heroes, and exposed COINTELPRO. I mean, just absolute heroes. As far as your own records that you got through the Freedom of Information Act or were thwarted from getting through FOIA, I'll note that journalist Jason Leopold and I, who's a fellow FOIA proselytizer, are currently working on a FOIA project seeking to explore FBI, CIA, and broader intelligence investigations and suppression of American journalists. And so if you'd like to try again and have us try and get these records for you and perhaps take a look
I think it would be very interesting. And in fact, after I went through all this and, wrote articles in local newspapers in Boston about my experience and demanding access to this information, subsequent to this, the FBI seemed to have tightened up its disclosure policies, and it was other people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, when you were trying to do it in the 1970s, is something of a Wild West period for FOIA and the FBI. The Freedom of Information Act was only amended in 1974 in the wake of Watergate to first apply to law enforcement agencies. So before 1974, the FBI, FOIA did not apply to the FBI at all. Since 1974, the FBI has understood the Freedom of Information Act itself as a threat to national security now that it applied to the FBI, and the FBI has done everything in its power since then to try and really exempt itself from FOIA. And what they've failed to do statutorily, they've succeeded just as far as how they process the act. And so it's much harder to get information now from the FBI than it was then before they figured out how to get around it. In fact, in my own district, the FBI is arguing in court right now, because I have another Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the FBI right now pertaining to my dissertation research, in which the FBI is arguing in court that my dissertation research is a threat to national security, and therefore they shouldn't have to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. For my request on information about the FBI's investigations of the animal rights and environmental movements, which the FBI has designated the leading domestic terror threats in the country, without those movements ever physically injuring a single person once in this country.
Well, of course, all of this is, through the eyes of the beholder. To the government, all requests for information that in any way interfere with their ability to spy on the American people or the people of the world is perceived of as a threat. Now, let's go back to the Nelson Mandela case, because obviously you've gotten a bunch of press on this, including an article in the Mail and Guardian in South Africa this morning, which I saw, which will be read with extreme interest by people in South Africa. What's ironic to me is that this story was disclosed years ago. And in fact, the New York Times actually covered this story, as did the Associated Press. And the Associated Press, in its report on this, named a CIA supervisor, a person that was, you know, involved in all of this. And in fact, in my book, Madiba A to Z, I cite his name and I cite the reports of both the New York Times and the AP about this whole case, in a sense of validating your claim here that the CIA was involved. In fact, the CIA guy is quoted as saying, "We were very proud that we were able to turn over information. It was one of our greatest triumphs to turn over information about Nelson Mandela, okay, to the South African government." So they weren't shy about it back then. Now, in those years, of course, Mandela was in prison. He couldn't be quoted. He couldn't be his photographs couldn't be seen. He was basically defined as a terrorist, convicted of sabotage, and sentenced to life imprisonment at the Robben Island prison. So they must have felt they could get away with this and that nothing would ever change in that respect. Of course, they didn't have their crystal ball working and realized that Mandela would later come out of prison and become the president of South Africa. You know, that was like beyond anybody's comprehension at the time. But, it, you know, there was this admission. Now, what's interesting to me about it is now with Mandela dying, prominent journalists in the New York Times, including Bill Keller, who had been a former editor of the New York Times, wrote these glowing, praise poems of obits on Mandela, but they never mentioned any of this. In other words, they didn't look in the files of their own newspaper, in the records of their own newspaper, to cite this incident, which I think I and many other people have found as very significant. When I raised this in South Africa with people, because I did enjoy some access to Mandela, you know, I was basically told, well, what can we do about this now? All that's water under the bridge. Why bring it up? We have to build a relationship with the United States now. Let bygones be bygones. I mean, that was their attitude, you know, on a pragmatic basis, that they didn't feel like, you know, forcing the United States into an embarrassing apology over this would be worthwhile to them. But, you know, to us, the people who are not a government, not a bureaucracy, not a president, not a head of state, but people who are part of struggle for justice, this is something they have a right to know. And the fact that a student in Massachusetts is leading this fight to get this information, I have to say I really respect your fortitude in doing this. And obviously it's a story that has gotten some pickup now.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I'm very glad that the story is getting picked up. Honestly, one of the reasons that I submitted the request to begin with and filed suit, I mean, certainly a major part of it is to find out the truth of what happened here. And as you said, I mean, CIA operatives themselves have come forward and said that they did this and they were proud of it. And so I believe that is the case. However, I'm not actually making the claim that it happened. I'm asking for documents about what happened or what did not happen. I'm just asking for the documents. I mean, this is American history. This is world history. And we have a freedom of information.
You want just the facts. Just the facts, ma'am, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, but so not only am I interested in actually getting definitively once and for all what happened, and not just that it happened, but how it happened, why it happened, what was the decision-making process that led to it happening. But also, I mean, as you've been discussing completely correctly, it's been very distressing to me how little attention that there has been in much of the press coverage of Mandela's death. I was thrilled, of course, that there was so much coverage of it. But in all of this lionizing and lauding, of course, much deserved, as you said, there was a near, among much of the press, there's a near total absence of attention to the fact that our government put him in prison to begin with. And so one of the reasons that I wanted to submit the request in a lawsuit, in addition to actually getting the information, was to simply bring attention to these issues.
And I think you've done that in a way, and I'm going to make a suggestion now for how you might continue to bring this issue out. I would write a letter to the Attorney General of the United States and ask him to join your request for information, given President Obama's, you know, stand of, you know, incredible admiration for Nelson Mandela. He was his teacher. You know, Mandela was his inspiration to get into politics and all the rest of it. So I think to write letters to the President of the United States, to the Attorney General of the United States, and to all the members of the Black Caucus particularly, who were very, you know, forthright in supporting sanctions against South Africa, to ask them to join you in this lawsuit, to support this initiative, I think you'll be surprised to find that you'll get some response there. And once some of these people get involved, they can't be quite as easily dismissive of you as a student in Massachusetts. I mean, this is a part of our history. And also to involve the Smithsonian Institute, the Congressional Library, you know, in Washington, to ask them to join this lawsuit as a friend of the court, so to speak. I think you will build political support for this because, as you say, what you're trying to do is just get at the facts. The CIA obviously doesn't want to disclose the facts. But if confronted with requests by prominent people in Washington, this issue will take on a life of its own. It will become a bigger issue. I would also write to prominent Black columnists who are more likely to be concerned about this than maybe their white counterparts. I mean, this is one of the unfortunate ironies, you know, in the United States right now. You know, a movie like Mandela: Long Walk to Freedom just received the NAACP Image Award nomination, along with 12 Years a Slave and other, you know, other films and TV shows involving, you know, Black actors and actresses and the like. However, then the Golden Globes have nominated Idris Elba as best actor. But, you know, the Golden Globes is the Foreign Correspondents Association. Somehow in America, our own reference points always tend to be all, you know, as I say, AAU, all about us, not about anyone else. And I think what you've done here is you've driven a stake into the cover-up on this issue in a very perfectly legal and appropriate way to try to get information. And I would just encourage you not to stop there and try to bring allies into the mix, including, you know, the Civil Liberties Union and the national security organizations that are concerned about these issues. And I think you will find people will be very responsive to joining in on this. And I think, Ryan, it will have more of an impact that way. You think that's possible?
I like that idea a lot, actually. That's really interesting. I'm going to discuss it with my attorney and see what he has to say, Jeffrey Light, who is a fantastic FOIA specialist. But I like that idea a lot. I'm definitely
going to send a few letters and let us know what happens, because I believe you'll find, you know, interest in this, you know, and, you know, there are many members of Congress who've been very identified with the anti-apartheid struggle. John Conyers is a friend of mine, and you can write to him and mention me, okay? Congressman from Detroit, one of the oldest serving member of the Black Caucus. I think he's the oldest serving member of Congress now. You know, I think they'll join. They'll say, look, I started this, and you know, it's gotten attention all over the world, and I think that they will try to avoid responding unless you and other people of goodwill join us. And if you do that, Ryan, I think that you'll give this more life. It won't just be an individual initiative, because really you're acting on behalf of history here. You're not just acting on behalf of yourself as some academic exercise. May I say that?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm definitely democracy cannot meaningfully exist without an informed citizenry, right? And such a citizenry is not possible without broad access, public access to information about the operations of our government. I mean, I am an historian. I'm an historian of the policing of dissent and the political functioning of national security. I really am simply trying to get from the government American history, world history. I really am simply trying to provide the facts as to what happened. And I really like your idea. I'm going to consider that seriously, and I expect to do it. I'd be interested in discussing it with you further.
I'd be happy to, and I've sent you a copy of my book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. Please let me know what you think of it. It's out now next week. I'm going out to Salt Lake City and doing some book signings alongside the Sundance Film Festival to try to bring this issue to wider attention. And the issue that you've raised is one of the concerns that I'm raising. So thank you again for being with us. If you stay with us now, you'll meet some people who were involved in that raid on the FBI in 1971 in Media, Pennsylvania. You'll hear more about what happened, the backstory, and the ongoing story. So that's here on News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter. Stay with us.
I pledge allegiance to the card of the United States of Credit. One nation under debt, with bankruptcies, late fees, and high interest for all.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. Borrowing and debt. In debt, we trust.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC. NBC.
CBS. CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News. Worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
General. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Well, what better song to choose than Polarity One's Media War to talk about an event that occurred in Media, Pennsylvania, through the good offices of the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI. Some 40 years ago, in 1971, a group of activists in Media, Pennsylvania raided the FBI office and managed to make off with documents that showed that the FBI was spying actively on activists, and their work and the documents they actually liberated at the time is now the subject of a book and a film. The Citizens Commission was in the news this week. The book is called The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, published by Knopf and written by a former Washington Post reporter, Betty Metzger. It reveals never-before-told details about that famous March 8th, 1971 raid on the media office in Media, an FBI office, rather, in Media, Pennsylvania, including the short-term and long-term impacts of the revelations. Joining me now to discuss all of this is a man who is very... let's say, to use an intelligence word, very witty about all of this, very knowledgeable about what's happening. Now a professor of law at Temple University, for many years a civil rights lawyer who represented activists opposing the Vietnam War and government secrecy and surveillance. His name, David Carries. David, welcome. Now you're at Temple University. But welcome to News Dissector Radio.
Thanks, Danny.
Apparently, we've had some connection in the past.
Cornell, weren't you class of 64?
I was indeed. Yes, I was.
I remember your name. And weren't you a leader in the Northern Student Movement?
I was indeed in the Northern Student Movement.
And I did tutoring for that. That was one of my early civil rights ventures.
The Northern Student.
I remember you. I don't know that we actually met, but I remember your name.
The Northern Student Movement had a project, as we called it then, in Philadelphia. Frank Churchville was in charge of it. But I remember a march that took place in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, which
oh, yeah.
at that time, and maybe still, you know, is sort of a throwback to the last, to an earlier century. You know, people actually had ice delivered to their homes because of a lack of refrigeration. It was, you know, a pretty bad slum-like conditions there. Temple University, of course, in the center of North Philadelphia as well.
Yeah, and it is not much better. I mean, you look at the conditions. There's been a black middle class that has formed, of course, and that's an advance, and a lot of them left. But if you look at the mass of people that live there, it's really not much better than it was in the 1950s.
You know, because I worked in the Northern Student Movement offices in Baltimore, Maryland, in the neighborhood of East Baltimore, which later became very well known to television viewers through the series The Wire, okay,
yeah.
Or the drug dealing. And
actually, that's where I was too, Danny. That I grew up in Baltimore.
Okay.
So that the summer tutoring I did with the Northern Student Movement was actually in Baltimore.
So that was... That was an amazing summer, the summer of 63, that ended with the March on Washington. I was part of the committee of the March on Washington, one of the organizers of the March on Washington that summer. That's 50 years ago, oh my God. You know, and while we were in Baltimore, one of the things that we pulled off, I don't know if you were part of this or not, but was the effort to disrupt a segregated dance show. On television in Baltimore, where we integrated the show with the tutors coming on board, dancing with some of the activists from the neighborhood, and caused a tremendous uproar, and later commemorated in the movie about this incident, although the politics of it was sort of censored out at the time.
I don't remember that, but
yeah, it was one of the great moments, the first dance-in in the civil rights movement. But what we're talking about now is the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. Tell us about this group, how this got going, and what they ended up doing.
Well, it's first of all, if you just think for a second how, even though the times were different and there were lots of demonstrations and lots of people were taking risks, just think about what it would be like to say, well, let's break into an FBI office, just to see what they have in there and release it so the people will know, what their FBI is doing. And it was the brainchild of a fellow named Bill Davidon. He's a physics and math professor at Haverford College.
I met him, actually. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he was a longtime activist, a very kind of mild-mannered guy, but he concocted this idea. He recruited people who he thought could be trusted not to talk and not to get word around about it, and who had certain skills. They needed an assortment of skills. They couldn't go near the Philadelphia FBI office. It was in a big office building downtown. But at that time, the FBI had these resident agencies, and there was a suburban community, still is, called Media, spelled like the media.
I know. That part, I love that. I love that connection.
Yeah. There's lots of puns available for that. What they realized was that there was no security system, no night watchmen, no guards. Just a kind of lock and key like you'd have on your apartment or your house. And this was part of, I think you can say fairly, the FBI's kind of arrogance. You know, they had never really been challenged at that point. I don't know if you remember, Danny, the Ephraim Zimbalist show, the FBI, on television.
Sure.
But I watched it as a kid. I mean, he would subdue five criminals and he wouldn't even get his hair tousled. You know, he would just do it easily. And so they had that reputation as, you know, indomitable and just sort of
the
top
G-Men,
of the line.
The mighty G-Men, right?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of that was, of course, a myth in many ways. But so they had this office, so they realized it was vulnerable. They picked a time. It was on the second floor of an apartment building. So you had to be careful about making noise. So picked a time when some noise might not be heard. They went in the night of the Ali Fraser fight. And so everybody was, you know, watching and listening. And there was lots of noise around the fight. And one of them went in, a woman went in, posing as a student from Swarthmore, wanting to know about women's careers in the FBI. And she basically cased the whole place while they talked to her. So they knew where the file cabinets were. They knew none of the file cabinets were locked, where the doors to the outside were. And then one of them started by coming in and picking locks, and he had an additional lock had been added, and he didn't have the tools for that. So he went to this alternative plan where he had to push a door open that had a big metal file cabinet in front of it, so it would make noise if it fell or if he pushed it too hard. And anyway, he gets it open. The rest of them come in with just regular suitcases, and they took every piece of paper in the office and left.
Can you imagine what that must have been like on the next day of business when the FBI came back to the office?
Yeah, I'm sure it was not pleasant.
You know, what happened, you know?
J. Edgar Hoover, in their internal memos, they described J. Edgar Hoover as apoplectic. I mean, you can just imagine. He fired people. He blamed anybody. I mean, there was a guy who had interviewed this woman who went into case the joint as a student and just got her first name. Well, of course, she didn't use her real name anyway, but he was pushed out because he didn't get her name. So they went nuts, and he brought in 200 agents to try to find out who did this, but it's actually very interesting because it was a typical problem with American law enforcement that you see all the time. Instead of really trying to figure out who did this, they glommed on to this one guy that they were sure did it because he had raided a lot of draft boards. He was a leader in what was called the Catholic left at that time, named John Peter Grady. And so they were positive that Grady did it. So they had 200 agents, but all of them looking in the wrong direction.
Mm.
So, because Grady had nothing to do with it.
Now, what's significant about this raid was not just the fact that it happened, but what they ended up finding in those filing cabinets that really startled and shocked the nation, or at least got a lot of attention, which went beyond simple crime, cops looking for criminals. It was an active program to disrupt, to neutralize, to enhance paranoia in left, liberal, and social movements. Those were their words, wasn't it?
The words you used are the exact words in the documents. Their only mandate legally was to enforce the federal laws. This had nothing to do with law enforcement. There was no, the subjects were not involved in violence or even suspected of any kind of violation of law. It was people in left liberal movements that Hoover hated. It had a direction, you know. It wasn't just random. It was directed at left liberal, the whole range of movements. For instance, there were infiltrators sent into women's liberation meetings. And they would have to report every 2 or 3 weeks or so. And so each report would come in, and they'd say, well, the women had another meeting today, and one of them talked about problems in her marriage. I'll report again at the next meeting in 2 weeks.
Well, you know, that's, I mean, one of the things, though, about the FBI was it had been very effective in disrupting the Communist Party earlier. In many cases, FBI agents became the secretary treasurers of Communist Party branches. They were, you know, because they had a full-time salary from the government, they could devote the time to actually running the Communist Party.
The program was called COINTELPRO, standing for Counterintelligence Program, but it had a predecessor that went back to World War II and included just what you said. But right after this, they thought this John Peter Grady did it, and he was planning a raid on the Camden, New Jersey draft board. So they sent an informant in and helped them overcome with strategies and tools, and they paid for the whole thing. They even the FBI paid for the groceries to feed people, you know, while they were preparing for this raid. Because they thought, the FBI thought it was going to catch the media burglars as well. But they were on the wrong trail. There did happen to be two of the media people were arrested there. I was lead counsel on that, and that in itself is an amazing story.
Well, tell us about that, because they had these two people, but they didn't know it, right?
That's right. They didn't know who they were. They were still focused on Grady.
So as their lawyer, what were those times like? Try to give us a sense of those times, because, you know, there was a significant degree of paranoia in left liberal circles. There was a tremendous fear of fascism, of police state tactics and the like. We had the Black Panther Party being attacked, gunned down in some battles. We had
one of the revelations out of these COINTELPRO documents. Now, this document wasn't recovered from media, but the COINTELPRO program was revealed, and then Carl Stern, an NBC reporter, did a Freedom of Information Act request and eventually got the whole COINTELPRO program. And one of the biggest and fattest files in it was on black activists and black students. To Hoover, if you were a young black student concerned with civil rights, you were a subversive. It was that simple.
And of course, he targeted Dr. King very vigilantly.
Exactly.
And attempted to discredit him. And we still don't know, I think, the full extent of it, but it was certainly, you know,
They also show an involvement in the killing by the state police in Chicago of Fred Hampton. The FBI informant gave them a diagram of the apartment he was living in that pinpointed the bed that he stayed in.
I spoke with Flint. I forget Flint's last name, the lawyer in Chicago who has represented the Hampton family ever since. And in fact, 2 years ago, I was out there speaking at Rainbow Push, Jesse Jackson's headquarters, and I visited the Hampton home where, you know, people gathered on this anniversary of what happened there, which was really an amazing situation. In fact, a member of Congress turned himself in, who was, suspected, one of the Panthers who expected to be killed, turned himself in to Jesse Jackson in a whole ceremony there to try to give more visibility and to stop this type of police behavior. I mean, the Chicago police and the Gestapo seem to have a lot in common.
Well, in one of these FBI documents, after the fact, after everyone knows Hampton's been killed, they say, mission accomplished, which seems to say they're glad he got killed and that's part of the plan. But it could be interpreted other ways, but it's a pretty damning set of documents.
Now, as a lawyer, there was this case of the Camden 28, Camden, New Jersey, very close to Philadelphia, a community that is still, you know, devastated economically as it was
as
back then.
As bad as probably anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, one of the worst kind of third world cities in America. What happened there?
Well, there were over 350 draft boards raided during this period. I mean, the level of activism is so underplayed usually in the media. It was just stuff was happening all the time, including these break-ins to federal offices. And this one was a particularly difficult one because the draft board was in the fifth floor of the U.S. Courthouse building in downtown Camden. There isn't much of a downtown, but there's this small downtown area. And this was the other draft board raids that had occurred were people hiding in the bathroom until the draft board closed at night. Then they'd come out of the bathroom and trash the place and leave. But this one, you had to get up to the fifth floor in a building, a big office building in downtown Camden that had a guard at night, and it was quite complicated. Well, Hoover put this informer in, And he concocted, with, you know, assisted by the FBI and with all the money paid by the FBI, he overcame all the problems, came up with the plan. And now, see, the other thing that was happening was in Harrisburg, there was an arrest. It's called the Harrisburg Seven, usually, of the Berrigan brothers. They were leading Catholic activists in the Catholic left. And Hoover had them arrested for this ridiculous charge of trying to kidnap Henry Kissinger and to blow up tunnels in Washington. They had no evidence, and the U.S. attorneys had advised against even bringing a case, but Hoover then went public with it, made a big deal, and then they all backed him. They couldn't get a conviction on that, so they were looking really bad. There was this raid on the media office, the release of some of these things, and the Harrisburg case had happened, and they were being criticized for bringing vague conspiracies. And then they saw the opportunity, they thought, to catch the media burglars. So they set up the Camden 28 case. And they made sure that any problem was overcome. That one resulted, though, after a 4-month trial, really in the most significant victory on, certainly in criminal cases, of that whole period. It was a complete not guilty as to all the defendants and all 7 counts charged.
And you researched and wrote a memo for the participants in that case, is that right?
I was lead defense counsel.
So, and you fought the law, and instead of the law winning, you won, or the people won. It was quite an achievement at the time. I remember that. And I think the Catholic left acquitted itself very honorably in struggling
Absolutely.
Against the war in Vietnam. I was just with the late Father Paul Mayer, who was mm-hmm. at Occupy Wall Street. He came down there to be supportive to the activists there, and I had some time visiting with him. I had seen him before, and I asked him, are you, and he says, yep, because I had met him, I think, with one of the Berrigan brothers.
Yeah, I believe I met him back in the days. This is all detailed, by the way, Danny, in my memoir. It's called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer.
Well, that's a book?
Yeah.
Well, folks, you know, pick that up, because I think you'll find it fascinating, you know, in terms of the backstory to this news that we've just received, 40-year-old, a story getting attention. But what's significant about it, and the final point I would ask you to comment, is, you know, we're now dealing with this incredible NSA scandal involving Snowden, earlier involving
yeah.
Chelsea Manning, people who are bringing information out, being persecuted or prosecuted or demonized by our government. And it seems like these stories are part of this narrative of people fighting for information and truth up against a government that wants to deny access to truth.
They really are, Danny. I mean, what to me, the theme that runs through all of them is ordinary people who take extraordinary risks to themselves with no real possibility of gaining anything personally, so that the rest of us can find out what the hell our government is doing and hopefully do something about it.
Well,
it's all very very similar in terms of Snowden. I mean, there are factual differences, but I know the people, the burglars from media, are very sympathetic to Snowden.
Well, you know, I think I want to salute your, you know, lifetime commitment on these issues to civil rights and to truth and freedom of information. And of course, your clients and the people who you represented and worked with, who really took tremendous risks to bring information to the American people that we were deprived access to. And it was their efforts and the risks they took of long terms of imprisonment even death to try to get this information out. Earlier, we had on a young student from Massachusetts whose suing the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act and the CIA for information that they have withheld on their role in the arrests of Nelson Mandela in South Africa back in 1962. So there's a whole hidden history of the United States here to be disclosed and to be fought for and to be uncovered. So thank you so much for joining us today here on News Dissector Radio.
Thank you, Danny. You really did play a small role for me in terms of my initial start in
Well, in my life, it was a big role, but that's okay. you can get the podcast of this show on PRN FM. I'll have it in my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow morning if it's sent to me this week. And I'll also invite you to write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you have any comments or suggestions about how we can improve this program. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again next week.